title, The Black Box Theory of Consciousness. And, of course, consciousness is very important to us because if we're not conscious, then we are not doing anything with our lives. So, our speaker this morning is Dakin Ariel. He is a businessman. He, as a Cavalier student, he has given many talks on this platform. He has taught the classes. He has been part of project groups that have created our classwork. And he has also been working on planning teams for the growth of the Cavalier philosophy. So please, to hear about the black box theory of consciousness, please give a warm welcome to Dakin Ariel, who's coming already.
Good morning. So I guess looking out in the audience, I think most people here have had a name report. So I guess I'm speaking to people who have a fairly good notion of what I'm going to talk about. So really, black box is a technical term, and I have a definition here from Wikipedia. It's a technical term for a device, system, or object when it is viewed in terms of its input, output, and transfer characteristics without any knowledge required of its internal workings. Excuse me. Almost anything might occasionally be referred to as a black box, such as a transistor, an algorithm, a human, or the internet. So what we're going to do is look at some of our principles just from the black box theory. And black box theory is essentially you know what is going to go into something, and you know what comes out of it, and therefore you can make some deductions as to what's inside of it that allows that transfer or transformation to happen. So typically, say with an electronic device, they might attach a power supply, and that's the input. And on the other side, they might have some dials, and they're measuring voltage or amperage or something of that nature. And as they vary the power, they can see what the results are. In this case, we're going to look at humanity or the individual. Psychology is our, you know, basically our society's study of mind, and psychology has current theories relative to personality. We have theories that go a little bit beyond it, but I think it'd be good to start from the basics of what the current understanding of personality is, and why is personality, first of all, why is personality even being discussed? So personality, from psychology's point of view, is defined as a dynamic and organized set of characteristics possessed by a person that uniquely influences his or her cognitions, motivations, and behaviors in various situations. So I'm going to just draw the black box up here. Okay, so our inputs and then our outputs. And so we're going to just say personality is an output. It's characteristics, qualities of intelligence, and psychology and Cavalier philosophy have a unique understanding of measuring those characteristics and qualities, and they do it in different ways. This is the important thing, really, is that understanding, so this is a black box, and we're going to call it the individual. And the outputs are behavior and expression, and all of those are, shall we say, related to personality or the quality of intelligence of the individual. So what are some of the inputs? In psychology, the general theory is that personality, the output, is the result of the inputs of genetics and heredity and the environment. So here's the basic statement. Personality is thought to be determined largely by either genetics and heredity, or by environment and experiences, or by some combination of the two. There is evidence for all possibilities. Contemporary research suggests that most personality traits are based upon the joint influence of genetics and environment. Okay, so we have a certain concept in psychology that, okay, it's environmental and it's hereditary. And how do they determine that? I'm just going to put this up here. Heredity or genetics. One of the things they do is they say, well, let's look at environmental factors, which they might consider. Well, all the people that you're involved with, from parents, siblings, peers, teachers, any people you meet, they have a factor. They're part of your environment. Maybe place. Were you born in Canada or Afghanistan, or what year? Were you born in the Middle Ages or now? Were you born in Vancouver, Toronto? Is there something relative to your region that's unique? Like if you're in Kitimat, then you're exposed to more toxins than other people through the Alcan smelter. But anyways, there are factors that are environmental that are place-related or time. And you could also say there's other factors relative to concepts. So if you were born and raised in, say, the Hindu religion or the Jewish religion, you're going to have a different theory of life based on the concepts that are taught to you. So again, that has a shaping influence. And we're not saying any of these things are not wrong, and they are all important. But what we're saying is they kind of missed the whole key point about mind, which we'll get to in a minute. And last thing we can talk about is experience. You know, did you have some seminal experience? Maybe you're walking down the street and a car crashed into your best friend and died. You know, those things can be quite traumatic and create effects on you. So they say, well, there's a lot of factors there. We don't quite understand how they're going to relate to personality, but we just figure they're out there. And there's a general sort of acceptance that they'll never quite figure it out. I think that's pretty common. And in terms of heredity, what they do is they study twins, and they say, well, we'll look at twins, and they're genetically the same. What are their differences? And so we say the things that are the same may have a hereditary basis, and the ones they really love are the twins that maybe go out to adoption and are in different environments, and then they study them and say, well, see how similar this twin is to that twin. That must be, even though they're in different environments, they never knew each other, that must be a factor that would be hereditary. Now, we would agree with them that these are all important factors, but what we're going to do is look at them slightly differently. So first thing is that Mr. Parker taught the two basic principles are language and mathematics. That's how, as humans, we basically understand life. So, you know, your little baby is born, it's got emotions, but eventually for it to function properly, it has to have language, and it has to have a name, which is the key part about language. So I'll just put name. And, of course, that little baby was born into time, and so it's part of the finite, and there's a mathematical measurement relative to time that has a significance as well. So we're going to say, well, let's take a very sort of practical scientific approach, and we're going to say, if we're looking at name as a factor in personality, we're going to name that little boy Peter. And what we find is that the output when we do name that child Peter is that they're very individualistic, they're very independent, they have a lot of perseverance, they're loyal, they have all these qualities that are very strong relative to this characteristics that we would call individuality, and the negative expression would be dominance. Okay, so we're going to just look at that as a factor in analyzing qualities of intelligence. And of course, you all know that's the one quality. I'm just going to write this out. And of course, if we looked at a name like Diana, which is a 292, mathematically very strong in the twos, we'd find that she's very diplomatic, she's idealistic, intuitive, has a great empathy with people, but she tends to be passive. Procrastination is a key weakness. And so we're going to just put procrastination on that side. And as you can probably see, if we build up that matrix, what we have is the nine qualities that we measure human mind with. And you can look at it from a positive expression of that quality, a negative expression of that quality, but there's a, shall we say, a spectrum. And I won't fill out all the numbers, the words, keywords, because you probably know them better than I do. I'll just put it there. And that's basically our grid looking at the 1 to 9 qualities. And that's how we actually measure mind. And what we're saying is that by taking a name, we take, say, for instance, the name of cat, we reduce the mathematical symbols to their mathematical components, and we basically come up with a formula. And that formula looks at what qualities that person's going to be strong in. In this case, a 1, 5, 6. So they'd be very independent, but they'd also be very responsible. And we do recognize that, you know, just change of one letter, if that person's name was Bat, they're right away, their personality changes, and they are now dynamic and sales-oriented, very sold on self, but very determined and quite tense. So something as simple as a letter change actually changes the whole dynamics or matrix of personality. So we recognize that the first principle, and the most important, is name relative to, you could call it an environmental factor because it's coming from outside. Somehow it's transformed inside the black box of consciousness, and it comes out as a specific, predictable personality. Now, in psychology, they study personality, but what they can do is they can measure it through questionnaires. So you take a questionnaire and you fill out 20, 30 pages, and they'll start to tell you about all the qualities that you represent. And so they have different theories relative to how to measure these qualities. And interestingly enough, you probably have heard of some of them, but I thought one of the more popular one is called the 5 dimensions personality model. And so it's measuring 5 characteristics. And again, they're traits, and they vary from positive to negative. So interesting, I'm going to describe these, and you tell me what qualities they're measuring. So the first dimension is called openness to experience. So on one scale, one side of this range of characteristics is the ability to be independent, interested in variety, imaginative, versus a conforming, very practical, and interested in routine. So right away you see what they're comparing is the positive 5 to the negative 4. And one of the things about the mathematical principle is that there is a successive progressive build on each of these qualities. So the strength of the 1 is independence, but its weakness is its inability to merge with others. So the strength of the 2 is its ability to merge with others, but it has a weakness in being, shall we say, passive and not taking action. The strength of the 3 is the ability to be outgoing and very active and progressive, but it tends to be scattered. The strength of the 4, of course, is practicality and system and order, but it tends to not look beyond the details. Again, the strength of the 5 is its ability to expand and look at all new ideas, but it tends to be emotionally unstable and indulgent. The strength of the 6, of course, is to create that stability of mind and responsibility so that it can handle all things properly, but it can be lost in, shall we say, the smaller world of self and then be interfering and bossy. And the strength of the 7 is that ability to look at the bigger picture of philosophy and the cause and purpose of life, and yet without this stability and balance, then it becomes emotionally turbulent. And again, the strength of the 8 is its ability to be calm and objective, executive, and its weaknesses being unscrupulous. And again, the 9 is that great power of giving and love, and yet it can be lost in desire. So we have these ranges of expressions that psychology recognizes. They don't really see where they come from. They're just looking at the effect. But it's interesting that first quality is a strictly openness to experience is really just looking at the 5 versus the 4. Are they going to be versatile or are they lost in detail? The second quality that they measure in this dimension is what they call conscientiousness, the tendency to be organized, careful, and disciplined versus disorganized, careless, and impulsive. Well, to me, that sounds like they're looking at the positive 4 and the negative 3. Again, they're looking at this dynamic range of qualities. The third point is extroversion, the ability to be sociable, fun-loving, and affectionate versus retiring, somber, and reserved. So it looks to me that that's the positive 3 versus the negative 7. The 3 is that outgoing, expressive quality, and the 7 on the negative can be introverted and very unexpressive. The fourth range there is agreeableness. The tendency to be soft-hearted, trusting, and helpful versus ruthless, suspicious, and uncooperative. So here we got the positive 2 versus the negative 8. So they're getting close. They are measuring the qualities to a degree. They don't know how these qualities come into being. They're just getting you to fill out a questionnaire, and then you sort of say, oh, well, you're extroverted, and you're conscientious, and you're open to new experience. So again, it's a descriptive process. There's no understanding of what is the cause of it. And the last range of measurement is called neuroticism, and that's the tendency to be calm, secure, and self-satisfied versus anxious, insecure, and self-pitying. So we're looking at the positive 6 and the negative 9. So they're missing a few things. No, they're missing something here, they're missing something here, something here, something here, something here. So they got about 50% something here and didn't see too many one-ish qualities, although you could say that first one was relative to the one as well. Anyways, it is interesting that psychology, they can look at the effect, they can measure it, and they just don't see what the basic principle of it is yet. Eventually they will. And, you know, sometimes you think, well, that may be partially our fault because we talk in terms of philosophical theory, and they, you know, as soon as they hear philosophy, that, you know, scares them away because they look in terms of their own jargon and their own approach, which is much more, shall we say, limited in terms of not looking at the bigger picture. So the other factor here, so we've developed a chart, and you all know this chart, relative to the positive and negative expression of mind. And from that, looking at individual names, we can create a periodic table of conscious expression. And, of course, I don't have a diagram, but just to quickly, basically look at it, you would look at the 1 to 9 here on this axis and the 1 to 9 on this axis, and you'd have a 1 intersecting with the 1, so you have the 191 and the 112 and the 123, etc., etc., all the way to 999. And there's also a couple of extras. There's the names that don't have consonants, they're just vowels, and the names that don't have vowels, they're just consonants. So essentially you have essentially a 011, and you also have a 101, I guess, you know, if someone's name is A. I guess that would be a 191, so we'll put that aside. There are names that just have no vowels, and so they would essentially be handled differently. But essentially this periodic table gives you a complete picture of every mental characteristic or set of qualities. You know, you could look at this 1-6, what would this be? This would be like a 2-1-3. You know, that would be the third one down. You know, it would be 4, this is the fourth column, 4 whatever, 3, whatever that works out, that 4-8-3. So again, that set of qualities would be described, and we do that in our name report. That's why the accuracy, when we have people who actually review it and give you like an assessment from the free analyses, they're like 88%. From the name reports, they're about 80 in that 80 to 90 range. So typically the correspondence between their nature and their names and their birth date are very high. So obviously, there's the factor of the last name, which modifies things, but I'm just going to say, you know, we'll just take Peter Smith, and you have, you know, all the qualities of the specific names. And so I bring this up because there's two factors here, is that when scientists or psychologists are in studying heredity, thinking that, you know, they want to know what are the factors that are genetic, they're often actually seeing things that are family traits, looking down the, you know, the influence of the last name, the surname is creating the family characteristics. So, you know, Peter Smith, his father was John Smith, his grandfather was Fred Smith. All of that Smith is common and will have certain, shall we say, characteristics that might be misinterpreted as heredity, and that's why they make a little bit of an error in judgment there. The other thing is they think, well, because we split the twins up, we can measure them independently, but again, they're still not looking at name. And there's the famous Jim twins. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it. But the Jim twins were identical twins that were separated at birth and raised separately in different families, but they were also named identically, so they're both Jim. And, of course, their last names are slightly different, but they have a commonality. There's a similar soul number. So the individual qualities that were equal, you know, like very, very close track of their, you know, the things that happen in their life, the way they think, the jobs they attract, the people they marry, you know, the similarities were quite startling, really, right down to, you know, they named their dog the same name, you know, the wives were the same name, although there was two or three wives and they were in different orders. But it was quite interesting how the name would attract conditions in their life. And that's the other factor, is that the combined name of both the last name and the first name create essentially conditions in your life. And this is another factor that's very important. So if it was just as simple as, you know, just the first name, you would think psychology would have been able to prove it by now. But now they have to factor in another name and the combination of both. Now, the question arises, well, is Peter Smith, if you went out there in life, there's probably thousands of Peter Smiths, are they all the same? And obviously they aren't. And we recognize that everyone's a unique individual, but there is aspects relative to time that make them quite, which would be kind of a very unique aspect of their inner nature. So, of course, time of birth, we'll just take January 1st, 2000, and just say 2000. So we have 1, 1, 2. So as an input, if we looked at children who were born on the 1st, just look at that one factor. If you took a statistical study and you went out there and you actually studied all the children born on the 1st, you would find that there were some commonalities, that they were all very individualistic. They had a certain quality of being very direct. They like to see things in black and white. And again, we start to, our theory is that we take the 1, 5, and the 7, and we consider that a particular division of this life force born into that child, and because we've attached mathematics to time, that there is a unique quality of consciousness that is incorporated relative to the date of birth. And that's easily provable. We haven't gone out and done it. We prove it every day from name reports, but we haven't gone out and done, say, 100,000 people. But eventually that will be done, and that's part of how science will come to accept the philosophy as true. We also look at the total of the month, day, and year, and we get a total, and we consider that a significant number, and that's a birth path. So that becomes a very important quality of consciousness that's relative to that life force that's born into the individual. So, again, that can be studied relative to having to do a statistical analysis. But essentially, we find that those inner qualities become the same pattern. They're transformed through the black box into a potential. Now, again, those are recognized through the name report. People say they're accurate. They recognize them as true. So I won't go into proving it, but basically, if you think about a seed, you know, you plant a seed and it comes up and it grows through certain particular ways that the intelligence of growth is built into that seed. Now, you could say, well, that's genetic. It is true. It's genetic on the plant stage. But when we look at the human, at that point of time when the initial breath is taken, initiates this quality. And so what is the purpose of humanity isn't to grow and produce an apple or a pea pod, but is to express consciousness. So that seed, which is measurable through the time of birth, becomes a really important factor relative to your overall purpose in life. So we're going to call this life force. So we can actually start to look inside the black box. I'm going to divide it up into three. And we're going to say that there's some factor of mind in there. And we do know that there's a life force that we can measure. And we do that through the date of birth, gives us the birth path, the group. It also gives us the pattern of growth. I think I could spell up here. Eh? So when you think about the cyclic law is not relative to name. It continues on whatever name you have, but it is relative to the life force. So because it's relative to time, it represents a cyclic pattern of growth for that conscious potential. So we're going to just call that potential. So we've used mathematics to measure mind, and we have a very complete picture of it relative to a description of how mind is created. So this is fundamental. This is sort of revolutionary. It's really quite astonishing. We have so much understanding of mind, and yet out in psychology, the world out there is just, you know, there's such a, really only a glimmer of describing qualities. There's no understanding of what is the cause. And so the name, the principle of name, or mathematical principle, is critical, but even as important is understanding this power of life, or life force, whatever you want to call it. Could be called the spark of consciousness. Religions call it the spirit. Again, they also call it the soul. And then you get all these different interpretations. Well, what is that? But we can agree that that the life force is linked to the breath. As you keep breathing, you're keep linked to it. And we also can measure it, and it's provable through analysis of the outputs of in terms of birth paths and groups, that it has a mathematical quality, and also that it has to do with growth. And we look at the growth of that potential relative to the mathematical principle as applied to time through cycles. So then we have the last thing here. We have mind, life force, and we have the physical body. Now, this is sort of like lifting the top off. We haven't actually looked at the mechanics of it, but we know that they're all mathematical. We know that this is measurable, this is measurable. We know that the physical body responds to the mathematics of name and potential as well. So we have someone like Peter, and what they do is they have head tension. And you change the name to a balanced name, and you create no head tension. So the physical is going to respond to this mental qualities and in terms of balance or tension. So in a sense, you could think about this black box has a bunch of dials on it, and I'll just say 9 dials. It's almost like a very complex radio, and the inputs relative to time and name adjust the expression. That's not, I think that's 9. The expression of those dials relative to what's going to be the output. And if a name is, and we talked about this periodic table, is that of, for instance, the 100 names, the most popular 100 names of any 1 year, we through our understanding of balance, there is only about one or two that we consider balance. So that means the majority of names are actually creating discord, and they will have physical challenges and tensions that are predictable. Now, the key thing there is that, I guess the question is, what is a balanced mind? Because that's the million-dollar question. And the balanced mind is basically a mind that allows the proper expression of these universal qualities of intelligence on their positive expression. And in doing so, represent this power of life unfolding through growth in a proper manner. So, simply put, we say that when the balanced name is invoked, then what happens is your inner potential, your birth path, will now become more naturally come to express. Of course, that can be accelerated through understanding the principles that we teach much more and then applying them. So, for instance, if you didn't know about cycles, how could you apply them? So, again, you have to know about them, then you apply them, and then you get the benefits. Same thing with the physical laws relative to health. If your dinner is peanut butter sandwiches, 5 nights of the week, so then you're going to have health challenges. So what you put in the body does have repercussions on the whole system, but more importantly is what you put in your mind in terms of the quality of thinking that you are involved with, because they will impact on the physical as well. So The other personality studies that they do are relative to type theories. The first one I was talking about was characteristics. Type theories are like Myers-Briggs, where they say, okay, you're either intuitive or sensing. So then they give you a letter. So you might be an NF or SP, and that has an indication of the type of person you are. So in a sense, we do that similarly in that the life force, if you say to a Cavalarian, well, there are five in the water group, that's a kind of a sort of a relative a concept that they have a certain quality of expression that they should develop versus, say, you're a two in the air group or an eight in the fire group or the water group. So we do have a much more precise measurement of that particular aspect. So the... see what else I have to say. Not too much. So I guess the key things here are that one is that we have the basic principle of how mind is created. That's through name. We have the means of understanding the inner potential or that life force, which is through the date of birth. We have also the understanding of the law relative to growth, which is through the cyclic pattern. We understand the principle of balance, which is the key to making your life a constructive one. It's not just in the balanced name, but it's in learning to express the positive sides of all of these qualities. So application really is this, you know, you're born into the emotions, so the emotions tend to be on the negative side, you know, dominance, passivity, intolerance, discontent, indulgence, interference, repression, unscrupulousness, and desire. Those are all emotional states. So the emotions are essentially more dominant than the thinking. If you look at the thinking, on the thinking side, you have individuality, you have diplomacy, you have self-expression, you've got practicality, you've got ability to conceive new ideas, reliability, philosophical depth, an executive broad vision, and universal love. So again, it's always this thinking versus feeling, and we have the born into the emotions. The mind has to actually make that transition to the positive expression of mind. So that's not unique to us. I mean, everyone, you know, all religions and all theories of life teach that you have to be constructive, you have to be charitable, you have to be giving, and yet they just don't know the principle of how that happens. So this is what the key is here, in that by knowing the basic mathematical laws, you have the actual steps for conscious growth, which you might call the mathematics of spirituality. So the current thinking today is pretty limited without the principle. I mean, they're intelligent people. They do all sorts of research. And you say, well, one of the interesting things is now, because our website is pretty well global and everyone gets to look at it and, you know, people talk about it and then they start thinking about name. There's an awful lot of more research on name. I don't know if you've bumped into it, but, you know, they do studies on, you know, what names are the most prevalent who graduated from university and what names do you associate with this quality. And so they're starting to actually do it in a way ad hoc without really understanding the big picture. But there is a growing awareness that name will have be a factor in your life. The key thing here, or I would say the key here, is that we have a set of principles, really principles that are provable and easy to understand. And I'm pretty well finished my talk, and you've got 20 minutes here. I'm wondering what to do here. Could take questions? No? Okay. Well, we could look at as an exercise just in looking at just how these all would relate. Is we'll just do. There was an interesting thing. I was going to work it in somewhere, but I never did. Was they were doing an interview with a lady who was about 107. I don't know if any of you heard of it. And they wanted to know what she did to be healthy. Why did she live so long? She's still alive. She's quite, you know, she's got all her faculties. And she said, well, you know, earlier in my life I realized that, you know, no matter what, I was going to learn to be happy. So it's interesting, you know, if you're happy, that is a positive expression that all the qualities draw from. All of those 1 to 9 principles, if you're happy, you're going to be drawing from the right side of the ledger, as it were. And, of course, that means the physical response to it, that vibration of mind, and actually you have more health. So it's an interesting anecdotal aspect. So I think we've actually covered, we're going to just take, say, any particular name. We'll just take Frank, 145, mathematically. Jones, that's about a 279, isn't it? So this person has a 325 total. And let's say Frank was born on February 7th, 1960. Oh, say 1950. So we mathematically will reduce this down. And what do we got? We got a 6 birth path in the water group. We've got a 145 name, a 279 family name, and a 3 total soul and a 5 destiny. So in a sense, what psychology would say, heredity or family traits, we can look at the Jones family. And, you know, they are very inspirational qualities. They would be people-oriented. They would probably be involved in their community or religion because they would be have this urge to be generous and giving. And all of these qualities are going to be part of that Jones family. Now, that's not a very vital name, so there's going to be health challenges relative to the fluid systems and the nervous system. So this would be not a healthy name. It's also somewhat intuitive and could be even psychic because of the sensitivities of the 2 and the 9. So there, that, again, would be a create discord in the mind because that really just represents an unbalanced expression of mind. But the Jones family, the mother and father, named this little fellow Frank, and Frank is going to be a real go-getter. He's got this urge to be his own boss. He'd probably be involved in some sort of promotion. Whatever his work would be, he would be very dynamic in promoting it and being very progressive, but also very self-centered. So Frank would have head tension, probably wear glasses because of that, or have problems with their teeth or ears when they're younger. And they would also develop ulcers because of the 5 expression, potentially, or tension in their stomach, so they'd have a sensitive stomach. So again, we have health challenges, this total combination where he's drawn into work where he'd have to be very expressive and outgoing and self-expressive, but his life is going to be a bit of a turmoil because of that 5 destiny. So we have people that will disappoint him in dramatic ways, and life could be kind of sort of a series of minor catastrophes. But inside the inner nature, we look at the birth path. So that's a stable 6 quality. So there's this urge to be responsible, reliable. There's this urge to care for others. It could be a natural urge for being a parent. They would have this quality of want to be involved in the community. So these are urges. Whether they come into effect, of course, is relative to the name. So if somebody's lost in self, it's not going to be as a natural expression for that 6 quality to come out. He's got the 2 first minor. He's got a middle minor of a 7, which is much more, again, both of them are very sensitive qualities, and a final minor of a 6. So being a water group, he would have this urge to be a natural self-starter, a leader, self-educated. They sort of take things, they like things direct, you know, they like things straightforward, and they are they don't have a lot of empathy as an inner nature for others, but they have this quality of doing what they think is the right thing to do and being pioneering it and going forth. So these qualities with this set of names would you know, we know the names are unbalanced, so these qualities would only come out to some degree. They'd be there sort of as a background influence, but they wouldn't really be a natural fulfillment in his life. And, of course, the conditions that he would attract would be quite chaotic because of the destiny. So what we've done is we've looked at the environment that he will attract because of the name and his inner nature. The heredity factor is more the family influence. And the personal nature or personality is relative to there, plus all the other factors combined. I think, in a sense, this principle, in a sense, supersedes all other theories, because we haven't actually gone and asked Frank 35 pages of questions to find out what he is. We've looked at how his mind is actually formed, and by doing so, we've actually and verified it, and actually, therefore, we've gone to the basic principle. So all of the other things that psychology is sort of involved with are non-basic. They're not the fundamental principle. They're important, but they're also just sort of peripheral to the key. So Frank, whether Frank was born in a family of wealth or a family of poverty, he's still going to have those qualities to draw on. So it really, those other factors are less important in this bigger picture. So you get to go home early today because I have nothing else to say. Thank you for your attendance.
Thank you very much, Deacon. That was an excellent presentation. We do have a sound bite. We always have little sound bites because the purpose of Morning Philosophy is to develop speakers as well as give us an opportunity to start our week with a philosophical thought. And so we never pressure our speakers to fit into a particular time frame. And we do have a five-minute soundbite. One of the telecast questions answered by Mr. Ivan Shearing on the topic of optimism. So I believe we're ready with that backstage.
Of optimism. What part does it play in creating, maintaining a happy mind? What role does it play in mental growth and stability? Can optimism interfere with people seeing the reality of life or not facing the realities of life? Optimism is that first form of expression of the attractive force. If you're not optimistic, how can you attract something better? You say, well, that's not being realistic. You've got to see that the results here. Look, we owe all this much money. We have only got this much money. We're broke. And so someone says, well, all right. Tomorrow's another day. We'll find some money. You say, no, me, well, which mind is going to attract something? They'll both attract something, but only the optimistic one will attract something better. Now, maybe they won't find anything better tomorrow, because it doesn't mean to say that just because they're optimistic, it's going to happen. There are many factors involved. But the point I want to make is that optimism is the seed of the future. Optimism is like the nine qualities. And when the one comes around, the vision or the seed of the nine is seeded into the one to start things going. And so we should always be optimistic over the future. What does it play in creating a happy mind? Well, my goodness, I think everyone is happier thinking of something better than thinking of something worse. When you think of something worse, it's depressing. When you think of something better, it's encouraging, it's inspiring, and it's hopeful. And so that is how one's mind can help create the future, by having this optimism regarding what one wants to bring about in the future. And stability, well, it gives a foundation. Optimism is like an anchor. It helps you to stay you might say, stable, whereas pessimism we're never going to get out of this hole. You know, it's only going to drag you down, and it's like a big wind dragging the boat, even though it's got its anchor out, it just drags it on its anchor. Well, optimism is a stronger anchor, if you like, to help you withstand the buffeting of challenges because you've got some hope that's based on your optimism. Can optimism interfere with people seeing the reality of life or not facing the realities of life? Well, that's not optimism. That is a misconcept. Optimism is seeing and wishing for the positive potential. It doesn't mean that one has to be illogical or unrealistic. It means that one has to take the circumstances and elevate them to a better level. Now, whatever the realities are, they're going to change, and you can change them, hopefully, with your the creativity of your mind. So everyone should be optimistic. If you don't believe in yourself, how can you look at the future if you don't think, well, I can do that, I can do it better. I'm learning, etc. Just see a better, happier future. How important is it to maintain optimism when all around you the world is losing theirs? Well, the others don't have the principle, and you do. It is very important, very, very important to maintain the optimism throughout all of life, even under the last breath.
Well, that's a very good thought to carry forward through the week, and it tied in with Dakin's presentation very well. So, announcements of what's coming up. We have a very busy month, but I'll just give the announcements up until the next Morning Philosophy, which is in 2 weeks' time on the 18th of this month. That day is also, there will be a brunch, a very special brunch, and it's called the Apple Harvest, which is put on by the Cavalry Men's Club, and there is a very special brunch with Klondike omelets, and there are pies and apples for sale, and it's an excellent fundraiser. So the class is at 10 a.m. and at 11 a.m. we have the brunch. This next weekend, in between today and the weekend following, is the Thanksgiving weekend, and students can go to Kalaway Bay Resort for a special fall weekend. And the office will be closed on the 12th. This month, starting on the 6th, next Tuesday, there will be the beginning of an 8-week class of healthy living. And I believe this is a change on the calendar. The originally scheduled how to be mentally free, but found it was more important to put on the healthy living. And so for 8 weeks, four this month and four next month, healthy living is on Tuesday nights at 7:30 p.m. If anyone wishes to register, please call the office in the daytime hours. So now I have to be optimistic and adjust the dials of my black box and think about singing. We start our morning philosophies with a unifying thought and three deep breaths, and we close our morning philosophies with a song. We're unifying our minds and our voices in song. Creativity, creative expression is a part of balanced living. So this morning,
We have the song number 20, The Sunshine of Your Smile, if you would all join me in it. And Ross, would you turn the mic off, please?
Michelle.
The moderator has left the conference.